Chapter 33. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy and gardenias bring us into late November. The former is a more invasive form of chemo, where a port through which drugs are administered is essentially sewn into the abdominal cavity. It's more direct than previous rounds, and it requires Bella to lie flat on her back during the procedure. She's nauseous constantly and throws up violently. The gardenias have somehow become our wedding flower, even though their lifespan is approximately 5.5 minutes. I'm dealing with the flowers on the phone at work when Aldridge stops by my office. I hang up on the florist with no explanation. "I just got off an interesting phone call with Anya and Jordy," he tells me. He sits in one of my round gray chairs. "Oh, yeah? I imagine you know what I'm going to say," he says. "I don't." "Think about it." I rearrange a notepad and a paperweight on my desk. "They don't want to go public." "Bingo. They've changed their minds." He clasps his hands and sets them on my desk. "I need to know if you've had any further contact with them." "I haven't," I say. "Just that one dinner in which I could feel Anya's resistance. But to tell you the truth, I'm not altogether convinced going public right now is the right move."
"For who?" Aldridge asks.
"All of us," I say. "I think the company under their guidance will grow increasingly profitable. I think they will employ us now because they trust us, and I think when they eventually do go public, everyone will make a lot more money." Aldridge takes his hands back. His face is unreadable. I keep mine steady. "I'm surprised." I feel my stomach tighten into familiar knots. I've spoken out of turn.
"And impressed," he says. "I didn't think you were a gut lawyer."
"What do you mean?" I ask. Aldridge sits back. "I hired you because I could tell no one would ever get a mistake by you. Your work is meticulous. You read every single line of every single paragraph, and you know the law backward and forward."
"Thank you."
"But even that, as we know, is not enough. All the preparedness in the world cannot stop the unexpected from happening. Truly great lawyers know every inch of their deal, but often they make decisions based on something else. The presence of an unknown force that, if listened to, will betray exactly the way the tide is turning. That's what you did with Jordy and Anya. And you were right."
"I was?"
Aldridge nods. "They're hiring us to replace in-house counsel, and they'd like you to head up the team." My eyes widen. I know what this means. This is the case, the client. This is the thing I need before I make junior partner.
"One thing at a time," Aldridge says, reading me. "But congratulations."
He stands, so do I. He shakes my hand.
"And yes," he says. "If this goes well, yes."
I check the clock, 2:35 p.m. I want to call Bella, but she had a session this morning and I know she'll be asleep. I try David.
"Hey," he says, "what's wrong?"
I realize I've never called him during the day before. If I have something to tell him, I always email or I just wait.
"Nothing's wrong."
"Oh," he starts, but I cut him off. "Aldridge just gave me my junior partner case."
"You're kidding," David says. "That's great."
"It's the women who run QT. They don't want to sell right now, but they want me to head up legal."
"I'm so proud of you," David says. "Will it still involve being in California?"
"Probably a little bit, but we haven't gotten there yet. I'm just excited because it's the right thing, you know? Like, I felt it. I knew it was the right thing." I hear background talking. David doesn't answer immediately.
"Yeah," he says. "Good. Then hang on."
"Me?"
"No," he says. "No, listen, I have to go. Let's celebrate tonight. Whenever you want, email Lydia and she'll make a reservation."
He hangs up. I feel lonely then, the sensation of which spreads out like a fever until the whole of my body is afflicted. I shouldn't. David is supportive. He's encouraging and understanding. He wants me to succeed. He cares about my career. He'll sacrifice for me to have what I want. I know this is the covenant we made, that we will not get in each other's way. But sitting here at my desk, I realize something else. We've been on these parallel tracks, David and I,
moving constantly forward in space, but never actually touching, for fear of throwing each other off course. Like if we were aligned in the same direction, we'd never have to compromise. But the thing about parallel tracks is that you can be inches apart, or miles. And lately it feels like the width between David and me is extraordinary. We just didn't notice because we were still looking at the same horizon. But it dawns on me that I want someone in my way. I want us to collide. I call Lydia. I ask her to make a reservation at Dante, an Italian cafe in the West Village we both love. 7:30 p.m. Chapter 34. I arrive at the restaurant, a corner one, tiny and candlelit, with old-fashioned red checkered tablecloths, and David is already there, bent over his phone. He has on a blue sweater and jeans. The hedge fund is a less dressy environment than the bank he worked at before, and he can get away with jeans much of the time. "Hi," I say. He looks up and smiles. "Hey, traffic was a nightmare, right? I'm trying to figure out why they closed down 7th Avenue. We haven't been here in a long time, since we first started dating," he says. David and I were introduced through my old colleague, Adam. We both worked as clerks at the same time in the DA's office. The hours were long and the pay was shitty, and neither one of us was particularly suited for that kind of environment. For about 6 months, I remember having a crush on Adam. He was from New Jersey, liked sitcoms from the 70s, and knew how to get the temperamental coffee maker to deliver a cappuccino. We spent a lot of time together at work, bent over our desks eating $5 ramen from the food truck downstairs. He threw a party for his birthday at this bar I'd never been to, 10 Bells on the Lower East Side. It was dark and candlelit, with wood tables and bar stools. We ate cheese and drank wine and split bills we could not afford, on credit cards we hoped we could one day pay off. David was there, cute and a little bit quiet, and he asked to buy me a drink. He worked at a bank and had gone to school with Adam. They had even been roommates their first year in New York. We talked about the insane prices of rent, how it was impossible to find good Mexican food in New York, and our mutual love of Die Hard. But I was still focused on Adam. I had hoped that his birthday might be the night. I had on tight jeans and a black top. I thought we'd flirt. Scratch that, I thought we had been flirting, and that maybe we'd go home together. Before closing, Adam sauntered over to us and slung an arm over David's shoulders. "You guys should get each other's numbers," he said. "Could be a match here." I remember feeling devastated. That stabbing sensation you feel when the curtain is pulled back and what stands before you on the stage is the wide expanse of nothing. Adam was not into me. He had just made that very, very clear. David laughed nervously. He stuck his hands in his pockets. Then he said, "How about it?" I gave him my number. He called the next day, and we went out the following week. Our relationship built slowly, bit by bit. We went for a drink, then a dinner, then a lunch, then a Broadway show he had been gifted tickets to. We slept together on that date, the 4th. We dated for 2 years before we moved in together. When we did, we kept all of my bedroom furniture and half of his living room furniture, and opened a joint bank account for household expenses. He went to Trader Joe's because I thought, and think, the lines are too long, and I bought the paper goods off Amazon. We RSVP'd to weddings, threw dinner parties with catered spreads, and climbed the ladders of our careers an arm's length away from each other. We were, weren't we? An arm's length away? If you can reach out and hold the other person's hand, does the distance matter? Is simply being able to see someone valuable? A pipe burst on the corner of 12th Street, I say. I take off my coat and sit down, letting the warmth of the restaurant begin to thaw out my bones. We're well into November now, and the weather has turned with us. "I ordered a bottle of Brunello," he says. "We liked it the last time we were here." David keeps a spreadsheet of really great meals we've had, what we drank and what we ate, for future reference. He keeps it accessible on his phone for such situations. "David," I start. I exhale. The florist ordered us 3,000 gardenias.
What for?
The wedding, I say.
I'm aware of that, he tells me, but why?
I don't know, some mix-up at the florist? They're all going to be brown by the time we take any photos. They last for like 2 hours.
Well, if it's their mistake, they should cover the cost. Did you speak with them?
I take my napkin and fold it over my pants. I was on the phone with them, but had to hang up to deal with work. David takes a sip of water. I'll handle it, he says. Thanks. I clear my throat. David, I say, before I say this, you can't get mad at me.
That's impossible to guarantee, but okay.
I'm serious. Just say it, he says. I exhale. Maybe we should postpone the wedding. He looks at me in confusion, but something else, too. In the back of his eyes, behind the pupils and the firing optic nerve, is relief, confirmation. Because he's known, hasn't he? He's suspected that I'd let him down.
Why do you say that? He asks, measured.
Bella is sick, I say. I don't think she'll be able to make it. I don't want to get married without her.
David nods. So, what are you saying? You want more time?
He shakes his head. That we postpone till the summer. Maybe even get the venue we want.
We don't want this venue?
David sits back. He's irritated. It's not an emotion he wears often.
Danny, he says, I need to ask you something.
I stay perfectly still. I hear the wind outside howling, ushering in the impending freeze.
Do you really want to get married?
Relief sputters and then floods my veins like a faucet after a water outage. Yes, I say, yes, of course.
Our wine comes then. We busy ourselves with witnessing and then participating. The uncorking and tasting and pouring and toasting.
David congratulates me on QT.
Are you sure? He says, picking the thread back up. Because sometimes I don't... He shakes his head. Sometimes I'm not so sure.
Forget about my suggestion, I say. It was dumb. I shouldn't have brought it up. Everything is already set.
Yeah?
Yes. We order, but we barely touch our food. We both know the truth of what sits now between us. And I should be scared. I should be terrified. But the thing I keep thinking, the thing that makes me answer in the affirmative, is that he didn't ask the other question. The one I cannot conceive. What happens if she doesn't make it? Chapter 35. The chemo is brutal, far, far worse than the last round. Standing up is hard for Bella now, and she doesn't leave the apartment except for treatment. She sits in bed, emailing with the gallery, looking over digital exhibits. I visit her in the morning sometimes, Svetka lets me in, and I sit on the edge of the bed even as she's sleeping. She starts to lose her hair. My wedding dress arrives. It fits. It even looks good. The sales lady was right. The neckline isn't as bad as I thought it was. David does not mention the wedding to me for a week. For a week, I leave emails from the planner unanswered, dodge calls, hold off on writing checks, and then I come home from work to find him at the dining room table, a bowl of pasta and two salads set out in front of him. Hey, he says. Come sit. Hey, come sit. Aldridge said I have a good gut. But I always thought the concept of intuition was bullshit. All you are feeling is an absorption of the facts. You are assessing all the information you have, words, body language, environment, the proximity of your human form to a moving vehicle, and deriving a conclusion. It is not my gut that leads me to sit down at that table knowing what is coming. It is the truth of what is. I sit. The pasta looks cold. It's been out a long time. I'm sorry I'm late.
You're not late, he says.
He's right. We didn't schedule anything tonight, and it's only 8:30. This is the time I'm usually home.
This looks good, I say.
David exhales. At least he's not going to make me wait for it.
Look, he says, we need to talk. I turn to face him. He looks tired, withdrawn, the same temperature as the food before us. Okay, I say. He shakes his head. I can't believe I'm the one who has to do this. His tone sounds just a little bit bitter. I'm sorry. He ignores me. Do you know what this feels like? No, I admit, I don't. I love you, he says. I love you too. He shakes his head. I love you, but I'm sick of being the person who fits in your life, but not your... fuck it, your heart. I feel it in my body. It punches me right there, right on the tender underside. David, I say. My stomach clenches. You do. He shakes his head. You may love me, but I think we both know you don't want to marry me. I hear Bella's words echoed here with David. You're not in love with him. How can you say that? We're engaged. We're planning a wedding. We've been together for 7.5 years. And we've been engaged for 5. If you wanted to marry me, you would have already. But Bella... It's not about Bella, he says. He raises his voice, another thing he never does. It's not. If it were, God, Danny, I feel horrible about all of this. I know what she means to you. I love her too, but what I'm saying is, it's not the issue. This isn't happening because she got sick. You were dragging your heels way before that. We were busy, I say. We were working, life. That was both of us. I asked the question, David says. You knew where I stood. I was trying to be patient. How long am I supposed to wait? Until the summer, I say. I smooth the napkin down on my lap, focus on the plan. What is the big deal with 6 months? Because it's not just 6 months, he says. In the summer, there will be something else, some other reason. There won't, I say. There will, because you don't really want to marry me. My shoulders shake. I can feel myself crying. Tears run down my face in cool, icy tracks. Yes, I do. No, he says, you don't. But he's looking at me, and I can tell he's not convinced of his own argument. Not entirely. He's asking me to prove him wrong, and I could. I can tell that if I wanted to, I could convince him. I could keep crying. I could reach for him. I could say all the things I know he needs to hear. I could lay out the evidence that I dream about marrying him, that every time he walks into a room, my stomach tightens. I could tell him the things I love about him, the curl of his hair and how warm his torso is and how I feel at home in his heart. But I can't. It would be a lie. And he deserves more than that. He deserves everything. This is the thing, the only thing I have to offer him. The truth. Finally. David, I say, start. I don't know why. You're perfect for me. I love our life together, but... He sits back. He tosses his napkin onto the table, the proverbial towel. We sit in silence for what feels like minutes. The clock on the wall ticks forward. I want to throw it out the window. Stop. Stop moving. Stop marching us forward. Everything terrible lies ahead. The moment stretches so far it threatens to break. Finally, I speak. What now? I ask. David pushes back his chair. Now you leave, he says. He goes into the bedroom and closes the door. I take the food and put it mindlessly into containers. I wash the dishes. I put them away. Then I go to sit on the couch. I know I can't be here in the morning. I take out my phone. Danny? Her voice is sleepy but strong when she answers. What's up? Can I come over? I ask her. Of course. I travel the 20 blocks south. She's on the couch when I get there, not in bed. She has a colorful bandana on her head, and the TV is on. An old rerun of Seinfeld. Comfort food. I drop my bag down. I go to her. And then I'm crying. Big, hiccuping sobs. Shh, she says. It's okay. Whatever it is, it's okay. She's wrong, of course. Nothing is okay. But it feels so good to be comforted by her now. She runs her hands through my hair, rubs circles over my back. She hushes and soothes and consoles in the way only she can. I have held her so many times, after so many breakups and parental disappointments, but here, now, I feel like I've had it backward. I thought I was her protector, that she was flighty and irresponsible and frivolous, that it was my job to protect her, that I was the strong one, counterbalancing her weakness, her whimsy. But I was wrong. I wasn't the strong one. She was. Because this is what it feels like, to take a risk, to step out of line, to make decisions not based on fact, but on feeling. And it hurts. It feels like a tornado raging inside my soul. It feels like I may not survive it.
You will, she tells me. You already have.
And it's not until she says it that I realize I've spoken the words out loud. We stay like this, me in a ball in her lap, her curled over me for what feels like hours. We stay long enough to try and capture it, bottle it and tuck it away, save enough of it to last, enough of it for a lifetime. Love doesn't require a future. For a moment in time, we release what is coming. Chapter 36. I move into Bella's apartment the first week of December, to the guest room that still has clouds on the walls. Aaron helps me with the boxes. I do not see David. I leave a note on the table when my necessities are gone. He can buy me out, or we can sell, whatever he wants. I'm so sorry, I write. I don't expect to hear from him, but he sends me an email 3 days later with some logistical things. He signs it, "Please keep me posted on Bella, David." All that time, all those years, all those plans, gone. We're strangers now. I cannot fathom it. Hospital, work, home. Bella and I are curled in her bed. We inhale early 2000s romantic comedies like popcorn kernels while she hurls, sometimes too weak to turn her head all the way to the side. She has no appetite. I fill up bowls and bowls of ice cream to the brim for her. They all melt. I throw their milky remains down the drain. "Canker sores, open wounds, the taste of bile," she whispers to me, shivering under the blankets. "No," I say. "Chemicals being pumped through my veins. Veins that feel like fire, fingers up my spine, grabbing at my bones, cracking them." "Not yet," I say. "The taste of vomit, the feeling of my skin crawling with fire, that it's getting harder to breathe." "Stop," I tell her. "I knew the breathing would get you," she says. I bend down closer to her. "I'll be here for it all," I say. She looks at me. Her hollow eyes are frightened. "I don't know how much longer I can do this," she says. "You can," I say. "You have to." "I'm wasting it," she says. "I'm wasting the time I have left." I think about Bella, her life, dropping out of college, flying to Europe on a whim, falling in love, falling onward, beginning projects and abandoning them. Maybe she knew. Maybe she knew there wasn't time to waste, that she couldn't go through the motions, steps, build, that the linear trajectory would bring her only to the middle. "You're not," I say. "You're here, you're right here." Aaron sleeps next to her at night. Together with Svedka, we move around the apartment, choreographing our own silent dance of support. I come home from work the following week to find that the boxes in my room are gone. My clothes, my bathrobe, everything. Bella is sleeping, as she has been for most of the day. Svedka comes in and out of her room carrying nothing. I call Aaron. "Hey," he says, "where are you?"
"Home, but my stuff isn't here. Did you move the boxes down to storage?"
Aaron pauses. I can hear his breath on the other end of the phone. "Can you meet me somewhere?" he asks me. "Where?"
37 Bridge Street.
"The apartment," I say. I feel a pull from deep down inside of me, far behind my sternum, the place where my gut might be if I believed in its existence.
"Yeah." "No," I say, "I can't. Something happened to my stuff, and I have to..."
"Danny, please," Aaron says. He sounds all at once a very long way away. A foreign country, the other side of a decade. This is a directive from Bella. How can I say no? Aaron is downstairs outside the apartment when I get there, smoking a cigarette.
"I didn't know you smoked," I say.
He looks at the cigarette between his fingers as if considering it for the first time.
"Me neither."
The last time we were here, it was summer. Everything was blooming. The river was wild in green and growth. Now the metaphor is too much to bear. "Thanks for coming," he says. He's wearing a jacket, open despite the cold. I can barely see out of my hood and scarf.
"What do you need?" I ask.
He tosses the end of the cigarette down, snuffs it out with his foot.
"I'll show you."
I follow him back through the familiar door, into the building and up the rickety, wobbly elevator. At the apartment door, he takes out the keys. I have the desire to put my hand over his, yank it away, stop him from doing what he does next. But I'm frozen. I feel like I cannot move my arms. And when the door swings open, I see it all, splayed out before me like the inside of my heart. The renovation, exactly as it was. The kitchen, the stools, the bed over there by the windows, the blue velvet chairs.
"Welcome home," he whispers.
I look up at him. He's smiling. It's the happiest I've seen anyone in months.
"What?"
I ask him.
"It's your new home,"
he says. "Bella and I have been working on it for months. She wanted to renovate it for you."
"For me?"
"Bella saw this place ages ago when I was assigned the building renovation. Something about the layout and the light, the view and the bones of the old warehouse. She told me she knew you belonged here." He smiles.
"And you know Bella. She wants what she wants.
And I think this project has helped. It has given her something creative to focus on."
"She did all this?" I ask.
"She picked out everything," he says, "down to the studs, even when you guys were fighting." I wander around the apartment as if in a trance. It's all exactly the way I remember. It's all here. It has all happened. I turn back to Aaron, standing with his arms crossed in the middle of the apartment. All at once it appears as if the world is rotating around us. Like we are the fulcrum and everything is spinning outward from right here, taking its cues from us and us alone. I walk to him. I get close to him, too close. He does not move.
"Why?" I ask.
"She loves you," he says. I shake my head. "No," I say.
"Why you?"
I used to think that the present determined the future. That if I worked hard and long, I'd get the things I wanted. The job, the apartment, the life. That the future was simply a mound of clay waiting to be told by the present what form to take. But that isn't true. It can't be. Because I did everything right. I got engaged to David. I stayed away from Aaron. I got Bella to forget about that apartment. And yet my best friend is lying in bed on the other side of the river, barely 80 pounds, fighting for her life. And I'm standing here, the very place of my dreams. He blinks at me, confused. And then he's not. And then it's like he reads the question there, and I see him uncurl, unfold himself to what I have really asked. Slowly, gently, as if he's afraid he'll burn me, he puts his hands on my face in answer. They're cold. They smell like cigarette smoke. They are the deepest, truest form of relief. Water after 73 days in the desert.
"Danny," he says.
"Just my name. Just the one word." He touches his lips down to mine, and then we're kissing, and I forget it all.
everything. I am ashamed to admit there is blankness there in his kiss. Bella, the apartment, the last 5.5 months, the ring that sits on her finger. None of it plays. All I can think, feel, is this. This realization of everything that has impossibly turned out to be true.
Chapter 37. He pulls back first. He drops his hand. We stare at each other, breathing hard. My coat is on the floor, crumpled like a body after a car crash. I turn my eyes from him and pick it up. He starts. I close my eyes. I don't want him to say I'm sorry. He doesn't. He leaves it there. I walk to the wall. I know what I'll find, but I want to see it. The final, culminating piece of evidence. There, hanging on the wall, is Bella's birthday gift. I was young. I needed the money. I don't know what to say, Aaron says from somewhere behind me. I don't turn around. It's okay, I say. I don't either. All of this, he says. It's all so wrong. None of this should be happening. He's right, of course. It shouldn't. What could we have done differently? How could we have avoided this? This impossible, unthinkable end? I turn around. I look at him. His golden, shining face. This thing that sits between us, now made manifest. You should go, I say. Or I should.
I should, he says.
Okay. Your stuff is all unpacked. Bella hired someone to do the closet. Your things are all here.
The closet.
His cell phone rings then, disrupting the air molecules, disentangling us from the moment. He answers. Hey, he says gently, too gently. Yes. Yes, we're here. Hang on. He holds the phone out to me. I take it. Hi, I say. Bella's voice is soft and bright.
Well, she says, do you like it?
I want to tell her she's crazy, that I can't accept this. She cannot buy and gift me an apartment. But what would be the point? Of course she can. She has.
This is insane, I say. I can't believe you did this. Do you like the chairs? How about the kitchen? Did Greg show you the green tile sink?
It's all perfect, I say.
I know the stools are a little edgy for you, but I think it's good. I think
it's perfect.
You always tell me I never finish anything, she says. I wanted to finish this. For you.
Tears roll down my cheeks. I didn't even know I was crying. Bells, I say. It's incredible. It's beautiful. I could never. I would never. It's home.
I know, she says.
I want her to be here. I want us to cook in this kitchen, making a mess of materials. Running to the corner store because we don't have vanilla extract or cracked pepper. I want us to play in that closet, to have her make fun of everything I want to wear. I want her to sleep over, tucked in that bed, in safety, ensconced here. What could happen to her under my watch? What bad thing could touch her if I never, ever looked away? But I understand she will not be. I understand, standing here now, in this manifestation of both dream and nightmare, that I will be here, in this home she built for me, alone. I am here because she will not be, because she needed to give me something to hold on to, something to protect me, a literal roof over my head, shelter from the storm. I love you, I tell her fiercely. I love you so much.
Tanny, she says.
I hear her through the phone.
Bella, my Bella. Forever.
Aaron leaves. I wander through the apartment, running my fingers over every surface. The green tile of the sink, the white porcelain of the tub, a clawfoot. I go through the kitchen, the cabinet stacked with pasta, wine, a bottle of Dom chilling, waiting in the refrigerator. I go through the medicine cabinet with my products, the closet with my clothes,
I run my hand over the dresses there. One is facing out. I already know which one it'll be. There's a note attached.
"Wear this," it says. "I always liked it on you."
It's scrawled in her handwriting, her loopy calligraphy. I clutch it to my chest. I go to the window right by the bed. I look out on that view. The water, the bridge, the lights. Manhattan on the water, shimmering like a promise. I think about how much life the city holds. How much heartbreak. How much love. I think about everything I have lost there. This fading island before me. Chapter 38. It happens quickly and then slowly. We plummet fast, and then we exist at the bottom of the ocean for 8 days, an impossible amount of time to breathe only water. Bella stops treatment. Dr. Shaw speaks to us. He tells us what we already know, what we have seen up close with our own eyes, that there is no point anymore, that it is making her sicker, that she needs to be home. He is calm and collected, and I hate him. I want to ram him into the wall. I want to scream at him. I need someone to blame, someone to be responsible for all of this. Because who is? Fate? Is the hellscape we've found ourselves in the work of some form of divine intervention? What kind of monster has decided that this is the ending we deserve? That she does? It moves upward to her lungs. She ends up in the hospital. They remove the fluid. They send her home. She can barely breathe. Jill isn't there. She's staying at a hotel in Times Square. And on Friday, I find myself putting on my boots and coat and leaving Bella and Aaron alone in the apartment. I truck up to Midtown, through the lights of Broadway, all those people. They're about to go to the theater, see a show. Maybe this is a celebratory night, a promotion, a trip to the city. They're splurging on a feel-good musical or the latest celebrity play. They live in a different realm. We do not meet. We do not see one another anymore. I find her at the W Hotel Bar. I hadn't really known my plan, what I was going to do once I got there. Call her cell? Demand her room number? But no further steps are necessary. She's sitting in the lobby, a vodka martini in front of her. I know it's vodka because it's what Bella drinks. Jill used to let us have sips of hers when we were very young, and then make them for us later when we were still not legal. She has on an orange pantsuit, crepe silk, with a neck scarf, and I feel my stomach boil in anger that she had the energy to get dressed like this, that she has on accessories, that she still is able to believe it matters. Jill? She startles when she sees me. The martini wobbles. How? Is everything all right? I think about the question. I want to laugh. What possible answer is there? Her daughter is dying. Why aren't you there? I say. She hasn't been downtown for 48 hours. She calls Aaron, but she hasn't actually made her physical presence known. Jill opens her eyes wide. Her forehead doesn't move. An effect of injections, of the side of medicine she is fortunate enough to elect to use while her cells are not multiplying into monsters. I sit down next to her. I'm wearing yoga pants and an old U-Penn sweatshirt, something of David's I kept, despite. Do you want a drink? She asks me. A bartender hovers at the ready. A gin martini, I find myself saying. I hadn't expected to stay, just to say what I came to say and turn around. My drink comes quickly. She looks at me. Does she expect me to toast her? I take a sip hastily and set it back down. Why are you here? I ask her. The same question, a different angle. Why are you here in this city? Why are you here at this hotel where your daughter is not? I want to be close, she says. She states it matter-of-factly, no emotion. I start, but I can't. She needs you there. Jill shakes her head. I'm just in the way, she says. She's been ordering delivery to the apartment, sending in maid service. On Monday, she came with flowers and wanted to know where the cutting shears were. I don't understand, I say. Frederick, where is he? France, she says simply. I want to scream. I want to throttle her. I want to understand how. It's Bella. I take another sip.
I remember when you and Bella met, she says. It was love at first sight.
That park, I tell her. Bella and I didn't meet at school, but instead at a park in Cherry Hill. We had gone for a 4th of July picnic. My cousins lived out in New Jersey and they were hosting. We rarely visited them. They were conservative to our reform and had a lot of opinions on the level of Jewish we were. But for some reason, we weren't at the beach, so we went. Separately, Bella and her family were at that same park, although they, like us, were setting up shop in a home 25 miles from there. They'd come for Frederick's work, some kind of company barbecue. We met by a tree. She was wearing a blue lace dress and white sneakers, and her hair was in a red headband. It was a lot for a little girl from France. I remember thinking she had an accent, but she didn't. Not really. I had just never heard anyone speak who wasn't from Philadelphia before. She couldn't stop talking about you. I was afraid she'd never see you again. So we put her in Hareton. I look up at her. What do you mean you put her in Hareton? We weren't sure she'd make any friends, but as soon as she met you, we knew we couldn't separate you. Your mother said you were starting at Hareton in the fall, and we enrolled her. Because of me? Jill sighs. She adjusts the scarf at her neck. I've been less than a great mother, I know that. Less than good, even. Sometimes I think the only thing I did right was give her you. I feel the tears in my eyes spring up. They sting. Tiny bees in the lids. She needs you, I say. Jill shakes her head. You know her so much better than I do. What could I possibly give her now? I lean forward. I put a hand on her hand. She's startled by the contact. I wonder when the last time anyone touched her was. You.
Chapter 39. Jill comes home with me. She lingers at the door and I hear Bella.
Danny, who is it?
It's Mom, Jill says. I leave them be. I go out, I walk. When my mom calls, I answer.
Danny, she says, how is she?
And then, as soon as I hear her voice, I start to cry. I cry for my best friend who, in an apartment above, is fighting for the right to breathe. I cry for my mother, who knows this loss all too intimately. The wrong kind. The kind you should never have to bear. I cry for a relationship I've lost, a marriage, a future that will never be.
Oh, darling, she says. Oh, I know. David and I broke up, I told her.
You did, she says. She does not seem surprised. It is barely a question. What happened?
We never got married, I tell her.
No, she says. I suppose you didn't. There is silence for a moment. Are you okay?
I'm not sure.
Well, she says, that's better than some alternatives. Do you need help?
It's just a simple question, one she has asked me over and over again throughout the course of my life. Do you need help with homework? Do you need help with that car payment? Do you need help carrying that laundry basket up the stairs? I have been asked if I've needed help so many times that I've been allowed to forget the question, the significance of it. I see now the way the love in my life has woven into a tapestry that I've been blessed enough to get to ignore, but not now, not anymore. Yes, I tell her. She says she will email David. She will make sure we get refunds where we can. She will handle the returns and the calls. She is my mother. She will help. That is what she does. I go back upstairs. Jill is gone. Aaron is in the other room, maybe working. I do not see him. At the door to the bedroom, I see that Bella is awake.
Danny, she whispers. Her voice is light.
Yes?
Come up, she says.
I do. I come around to the other side of the bed, getting in next to her. It hurts for me to look at her. She's all bones. Gone are her curves, her flesh, the softness and mystery that has been her familiar body for so long.
Your mom left, I ask. Thank you, she says.
I don't answer, just thread my fingers through hers.
Do you remember, she says, the stars?
At first I think she means the beach at night, maybe. Or that she doesn't mean anything. That she's seeing something I can't now.
The stars? Your room, she says. The stick-ons, I say. My ceiling. Do you remember how we used to count them?
We never got there, I say. We couldn't tell them apart.
I miss that.
I take her whole hand in mine now. I want to take her whole body, too, to hold her, to press her close to me where she can't go anywhere.
Danny, she says, we need to talk about this.
I don't say anything. I can feel the tears running down my cheeks. Everything feels wet, wet and cold, damp. We'll never get dry.
What?
I say stupidly, desperately.
Then I'm dying.
I turn to her because she can barely move anymore. Her eyes look into mine. Those same eyes. The eyes I have loved for so long. They are still there. She's still in there. It's impossible to think she won't be. But she won't be. Soon she won't be. She is dying. And I cannot deny her this honesty. I don't like it, I say. It's bad policy. She laughs, and then starts coughing. Her lungs are full. I'm sorry, I say. I check her pain pump. I give her a minute.
I'm sorry, she says.
No, Bella, please.
No, she says, I am. I wanted to be here for you for all of it.
But you have, I say. You have been here for everything.
Not everything, she whispers.
I feel her search for my hand under the sheets.
I give it to her. Love, she says.
I think about David in our old shared apartment and Bella's words. Because that's the way you love me.
You've never had it, she says. I want the real thing for you.
You're wrong,
I tell her. I'm not, she says. You've never really been in love. You've never really had your heart broken.
I think about Bella at the park, Bella at school, Bella at the beach, Bella lying on the floor of my first New York City apartment, Bella with a bottle of wine in the rain, Bella on the fire escape at 3 a.m., Bella's voice on New Year's Eve cracking through the Parisian phone, Bella, always. Yes, I whisper, I have. Her breath catches, and she looks at me. I see it all. The cascade of our friendship. The decades of time. The decades to come. More, even, without her.
It's not fair, she says.
No, I say. It's not. I feel her exhaustion move over both of us like a wave. It drags us under. Her hand softens in mine. Chapter 40. It happens on Thursday. I am asleep. Erin is on the couch. Jill and the nurse are beside her. Those impossibly long, gruesome final moments. I miss them. I am in the apartment 20 feet away, not by her side. By the time I am awake, she is gone. Jill plans the funeral. Frederick flies in. They obsess about the flowers. Frederick wants a cathedral, an 8-piece orchestra. Where do you find a full gospel choir in Manhattan? This isn't right, Erin says. We are in her apartment, late at night, 2 days after she has left us. We are drinking wine, too much wine. I haven't been sober in 48 hours. This isn't what she would want. He means the funeral, I think, although maybe he doesn't. Maybe he means the whole thing. He would be right. So we should plan what she would, I say, deciding for him. Let's throw our own. Celebration of life? I stick my tongue out at the word. I don't want to celebrate. This is all unfair. This is all not what should have been. But Bella loved her life. every last moment of it. She loved the way she lived it. She loved her art and her travel and her croque-monsieur. She loved Paris for the weekend and Morocco for the week and Long Island at sunset. She loved her friends. She loved them gathered. She loved running around the room, topping up glasses and making everyone promise to stay long into the night. She would want this. Yes, I say, okay. Where? Somewhere high, somewhere above, somewhere with a terrace, somewhere with a view of the city she loved. Do you still have those keys? I ask Aaron. 2 days later, December 15th, we get through the funeral, through the relatives and the speeches. We get through being relegated, if not to the back, then to the side. Are you family? We get through the logistics, the stone, the fire, the documents. We get through the paperwork and the emails and the phone calls. What? People say, no. How could it be? I didn't even know she was sick. Frederick will keep the gallery open. They'll find someone to run it. It will still bear her name. The apartment isn't the only thing you finished, I want to tell her. Why didn't I see it? The way she ran that place, why didn't I tell her? I want to tell her now, taking inventory of her life, that I see all of it, all of her completion. We gather at dusk. Berg and Carl from our 20s in New York, Morgan and Ariel, the gallery girls, two friends from Paris, and a few girlfriends from college. The guys from a reading series she used to participate in. These people who have all loved her, appreciated her, and saw different parts of her flourishing, pulsing soul. We gather on that slice of terrace, shivering, coats bundled, but needing to be outside, to be in the air. Morgan refills my wine glass. Ariel clears her throat. I'd like to read something, she says. Of course, I tell her. We gather in a little horseshoe, spread out. Of the two, Ariel is shyer, a little more reserved than Morgan. She begins. Bella sent me this poem about a month ago. She asked me to read it. She was a great artist, but she was also a really great writer. Was, she shakes her head. Anyway, I wanted to share it tonight. She clears her throat. She begins to read. There is a path of land that exists beyond the sea and the sky. It is behind the mountains, past even the hills, those of luscious green that roll up into the heavens. I have been there with you. It is not big, although not too small. Perhaps you could perch a house on its width, but we have never considered it. What would be the use? We already live there. When the night closes and the city stills, I am there with you. Our mouths laughing, our heads vacant, of all but what is. And what is, I ask? This, you say, you and I, here. We are all silent after she finishes. I know what place. It is a field surrounded by mountains and fog, where a river runs through. It is quiet and peaceful and eternal. It is that apartment. I pull my coat tighter around me. It's cold, but the cold feels good. It reminds me for the first time in a week that I am here, that I have flesh, that I am real. Berg steps forward next. He reads from Chaucer, a favorite stanza of hers from graduate school. He puts on a voice. Everyone laughs. There is champagne and her favorite cookies from a bakery on Bleecker. There is also pizza from Rubirosa, but no one has touched it. We need her to return, smiling, full of life, gifting us back our appetites. Finally, it is my turn. Thank you all for coming, I tell them. Greg and I knew she would want something with the people she loved that wasn't so formal. Although Bella loved black tie, Morgan chimes in. We laugh. That she did. She was a spinning, spiraling spirit that touched all of us. I miss her, I say. I will forever. The wind whistles over the city.
and I think it's her saying a final farewell.
We stay until our fingers are frozen and our faces are chapped, and then it's time to go home. I hug Morgan and Ariel goodbye. They promise to come over next week and help us sort through Bella's stuff. Berg and Carl leave. The gallery girls tell me to come by. I say I will. They have a new exhibit going up. She was proud of it, I should see. Then it's just the two of us. Aaron doesn't ask if he can come with me, but when the car arrives, he gets in. We travel downtown in silence. We speed across the Brooklyn Bridge, miraculously devoid of traffic. No roadblocks, not anymore. We pull up to the building. The keys now in my possession. Through the door, up the elevator, into the apartment. Everything I've fought against, now made manifest at my very own hands. I take off my shoes. I go to the bed. I lie down. I know what is going to happen. I know exactly how we will live it. Chapter 41. I must fall asleep because I wake up and he's here. And the reality of it, of Bella's loss, of the last few months, swirls around us like the impending storm. "Hey," Aaron says, "are you okay?" "No," I say, "I'm not." He sighs. He walks over to me. "You fell asleep." "What are you doing here?" I ask him, because I want to know. I want him to say it. I want to get it out now, into the open. "Come on," he says, refusing. Although if it's the refusal of the inevitable, or the unwillingness to answer the question, I do not know. "Do you know me?" I want to explain to him, although I suspect he understands, that I'm not this person. That what has happened, what is happening here between us, is not me. That I would never betray her. But that she's gone. She's gone, and I do not know what to do with this, with everything she's left in her wake. He puts a knee on the bed. "Danny," he says, "are you really asking me that?" "I don't know," I say. "I don't know where I am." "It was a good night," he says, gently reminding me. "Wasn't it?" "Of course it was. It was what she would have wanted. This gathering of what she stood for, spontaneity, love, a good Manhattan view." "Yeah," I say, "it was." I catch the TV. A storm is coming, circling its way closer to us. 7 inches of snow, they're predicting. "Are you hungry?" he asks me. Neither of us ate tonight. I wave him off. "No." But he presses and my stomach answers in return. "Yes, actually, I'm starving." I follow Aaron into the closet, itching to get out of this dress. He pulls his sweatpants, the ones he still has here from all the work he did on the apartment, out of the drawer along with the t-shirt he left behind. The only things here that aren't mine. "I moved to Dumbo," I say, incredulous. Aaron laughs. "It's all so ridiculous. Neither one of us can help ourselves. 5 years later, I have left Murray Hill and Gramercy and moved to Dumbo." I change and wash my face. I put some cream on. I wander back into the living room. Aaron calls from the kitchen that he's making pasta. I find Aaron's pants flung over the chair. I fold them, and his wallet slides out. I open it. Inside is the Stumptown punch card, and then I see it, the photo of Bella. She's laughing, her hair tangled around her face like a maypole. It's from the beach, Amagansett this summer. I took it. It seems years ago now. We decide on pesto for the pasta. I go to sit at the counter. "Am I still a lawyer?" I ask him wearily. "I haven't been to the office in nearly 2 weeks." "Of course," he answers. He holds out an open bottle of red, and I nod. He fills my glass. We eat. It feels good, necessary. It seems to ground me. When we're done, we take our wine glasses to the other side of the room. But I'm not ready. Not yet. I sit down in a blue chair. I think about leaving, maybe. Not going through with what happens next. I even make a move for the door. "Hey, where are you going?" Aaron asks me. "Just the deli," The deli?
And then Aaron is upon me, his hands on my face, the way they were just weeks ago on the other side of the world.
Stay, he says, please. And I do. Of course I do. I was always going to. I fold to him in that apartment like water into a wave. It all feels so fluid, so necessary, like it's already happened.
He holds me in his arms, and then he kisses me, slowly, and then faster, trying to communicate something, trying to break through. We undress quickly. His skin on mine feels hot and raw and urgent. His touch goes from languid to fire. I feel it around us, all around us. I want to scream. I want to tear us apart. We make love in that bed that Bella bought, this union that Bella built. He traces his fingers over my shoulders and down my breasts. He kisses my neck, the hollow of my collarbone. His body on top of mine feels heavy and real. He exhales out sharply into my hair, says my name. We're going to break apart too quickly. I never want this to end. And then it's over. And when it is, when he collapses on top of me, kissing, caressing, shuddering, I feel clarity, like it has clobbered me in the back of my head. I see it in the stars, everywhere, all above us. I knew it all 5 years ago. I saw everything. I even saw this moment. But staring at Aaron next to me now, I realize something I did not know before, not until this very moment, 11:59 p.m. I saw what was coming, but I did not see what it would mean. I look down at the ring I am wearing. It is on my middle finger, where it has been since I put it on. It is hers, of course, not mine. It is the thing I wear to feel close to her. The dress, a funeral shroud. This feeling, this full, endless, insurmountable feeling. It fills up the apartment. It threatens to break the windows. But it is not love. No, I mistook it. I mistook it because I did not know. I had not seen everything that would get us here. It is not love, this feeling. It is grief. The clock turns. After. Aaron and I lie next to each other perfectly still. It is not awkward, although we do not talk. I suspect we are, both of us, coming to terms with what we have just discovered, that there is nowhere to hide, not even in each other. She's laughing, he says finally. You know that, right? If she doesn't kill me first. Aaron lifts a hand to my stomach. He chooses instead to make contact with my arm. She knows, he says. I'd imagine, yes. I roll to the side. We look at each other. Two people bound and tethered by our own grief. Do you want to stay? I ask him. He smiles at me. He reaches over and tucks some hair behind my ear. I can't, he says. I nod. I know. I want to crawl to him. I want to make my bed in his arms, to stay there until the storm passes, but I can't, of course. He has his own to weather. We can help each other only in our history, not in our understanding. It is different. It has always been different. I look around the apartment, this place she built for me, this haven. Where will you go? I ask him. He has his own place, of course, his own life, the one he was living this time last year, before the tides of fate swept him up and deposited him here, December 16th, 2025. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? You want to have lunch tomorrow? He asks me. He sits up. Discreetly under the covers, he pulls his pants back on. Yeah, I say. That would be nice. Maybe we could make it a weekly thing, he says, establishing something. Boundaries, maybe friendship. I'd like that. I look down at my hand. I don't want to. I want to hold it forever, this promise on my finger.
But it is not my promise, of course. It is his. I take it off. Here, I say, you should have this. He shakes his head. She wanted you. No, I say, she didn't. This is yours. He nods, takes it back. Thank you. He stands up. He puts on his shirt. I use the time to get dressed as well. Then he stops, realizing something. We could drink some more wine, he says, if you don't want to be alone. I think about that, about the promise of this space, this time, tonight. I'm okay, I say. I have no idea if it's true. We walk across the apartment silently, our feet light on the cool concrete. He pulls me into a hug. His arms feel good and strong, but gone is the charge, the kinetic energy pulling, asking, demanding to be combusted. Get home safe, I say. And then he is gone. I stare at the door a long time. I wonder whether I will see him tomorrow, or whether I will get a text, an excuse. Whether this is the beginning of goodbye for us too. I do not know. I have no idea what happens now. I walk around the apartment for an hour, touching things. The marble countertops, the grainiest shade of green, the black wood cabinets, the cherry wood stools. Everything in my apartment has always been white, but Bella knew I belonged in color. I go to the orange dresser, and that's when I see a framed photo sitting on top of it. Two teenagers, arms wrapped around each other, standing in front of a little white house with a blue awning. You were right, I say. I start to laugh then. The hysterical sobs of someone caught between irony and grief. The woven tapestry of our friendship continuing to reveal itself even now, even in her absence. Outside, across the street from the apartment, right by Galapagos, I can see it start to snow. The first fall of the year. I put down the picture. I wipe my eyes. And then I pull on my rubber boots. I grab my down jacket and scarf from the closet. Keys, door, elevator. Outside, the streets are empty. It's late. It is Dumbo. It is snowing. But from a block over, I see a light. I turn the corner. The deli. I wander in. There is a woman behind the counter sweeping, but the place is warm and well lit, and she doesn't tell me they're closed. They're not. I look up at the board, the array of sandwiches, none of which I've ever touched. I'm not hungry, not at all, but I think about tomorrow, about coming here and getting egg salad on a bagel or tuna on rye, a breakfast sandwich, eggs and tomato and cheddar and wilted arugula, something different. The door jangles behind me, a tinkling of holiday bells. I turn around and there he is. Danny, Dr. Shaw says, what are you doing here? His cheeks are red, his face open. He's no longer in scrubs, but in jeans and a jacket open at the collar. He is handsome, of course, in the way familiarity is beautiful, if not a little worn, a little tattered. Dr. Shaw, please, he says. Call me Mark. He extends his hand. I take it. We will stay in that deli until they close, sipping on coffee that turns cold, which is an hour from now. He will walk me home. He will say he is very sorry for my loss, that he never knew I lived in Dumbo. I will tell him I didn't, not until now. He will ask if perhaps he can see me again, perhaps at that deli when I am ready. I will tell him yes, perhaps, perhaps. But all of that is an hour from now. Now, on the other side of midnight, we do not yet know what is coming. So be it. So let it be.
In 5 years, a novel was written by Rebecca Searle and read by Megan Hilty. It was recorded by Mark De La Fuente and Chris Gardner at Dave and Dave Recording Studios in Los Angeles, California. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2000 Pounds. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. In 5 Years was produced and directed by Randy Dolnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. In 5 Years, a novel is available in print from Atria Books.